Santan knew that she was drowning. She had been sucked so deeply beneath the surface that her lungs were crushing under the weight of the dark waters. Her head was full of the monstrous roaring of the sinking ship and of the crackle and squeal of the pressure in her own eardrums. She knew she was doomed, but she fought with all her strength and determination, kicking and clawing for life against the cold, leaden drag of waters, fighting against the burning agony of her lungs and the need to breathe. But the turbulence swirled her into vertigo, so that she lost any sense of upward and downward movement, but still she fought on, and she knew that she would die fighting for her baby's life. Then suddenly she felt the cracking weight of water on her ribs releasing, felt her lungs swelling in her chest, and an updraft of air and bubbles from the ruptured hull pulled her up like a spark from a campfire and hurled her towards the surface, with a pressure pain burning in her eardrums and the drag of the life jacket cutting into her armpits. She broke through the surface and was thrown high on the seething fountain of escaping air. She tried to breathe but took water into her straining lungs and coughed and wheezed in agonized paroxysms until she cleared her air passages, and then it was almost as though the sweet sea air was too strong and rich for her. It burned like fire, and she gasped and laboured like an asthmatic. Slowly she managed to control her breathing, but the waves came at her unexpectedly out of the darkness, breaking over her head, smothering her again, so that she had to train herself to regulate each breath to the rhythm of the ocean. Between the breaking swells, she tried to assess her own condition and found herself undamaged. No bone seemed broken or cracked, despite that terrible gut-swooping drop from the ship's rail and the stunning impact on water as hard as a cobbled street. She still had full control of her limbs and her senses, but then she felt the first stealthy invasion of the cold through her clothing, into her body and her blood. "I've got to get out of the water," she realized. "One of the lifeboats." Now for the first time she listened for sounds, and at first there was only the wind and the rushing break of the white caps. Then she heard, faintly, very faintly, a gabble of human voices, a magpie chorus of croaks and cries, and she opened her mouth and called for help, but a wave broke in her face, and she took more water and gasped and choked. It took her minutes to recover, but as soon as her lungs were clear, she struck out grimly towards where she thought the voices were, no longer wasting strength on vainly beseeching the aid of others. The heavy life jacket dragged, and the crests broke over her. She was lifted on the swells and dropped into the troughs, but she kept swimming. "I have to get out of the water," she kept telling herself. "The cold is the killer. I have to reach one of the boats." She reached out for the next stroke and hit something solid with a force that broke the skin of her knuckles, but instantly she grasped for it. It was something large that floated higher than her head, but she could find no secure handholds upon it, and in panic realized that she already was too far gone to drag herself up by main strength. She began to grope her way around the piece of floating wreckage, searching for a handhold.
"Not big."
In the darkness, she judged it to be not more than 12 feet long and half as broad, made of timber but coated with smooth oil paint, one edge of it torn and splintered, so that she scratched her hand on it. She felt the sting of the tearing skin, but the cold numbed the pain. One end of the wreckage floated high, the other end dipped below the surface, and she pulled herself onto it, belly down. Immediately, she felt how precariously balanced the structure was. Although she had only dragged her upper body onto it, and her legs from the waist down were still hanging in the water, the wreckage tipped dangerously towards her, and there was a hoarse cry of protest.
"Be careful, you bloody fool! You'll have us over!"
Somebody else had found the raft before her.
"I'm sorry," she gasped. "I didn't realize."
"All right, lad, just be careful."
The man on the raft had mistaken a voice for that of one of the ship's boys. "Here, give me a hand." Santan groped frantically and touched outstretched fingers. She seized the offered hand.
"Easy does it."
She kicked as the man pulled her up the sloping angle of slippery painted wreckage, and then with her free hand she found a hold. She lay belly down on the tossing, unstable deck, and felt suddenly too weak and trembling to lift her head. She was out of the deadly water.
"Are you all right, son?"
Her rescuer was lying beside her, his head close to hers.
"I'm all right, though."
She felt the touch of his hand on her back.
"You've got a life jacket. Good boy. Use the tapes to tie yourself to this strut. Here, let me show you."
He lashed Santan to the strut in front of her.
"I've tied a slippery knot. If we capsize, just pull this end, savvy?"
"Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
Save it for later, lad."
The man beside her lowered his head onto his arms, and they lay shivering and sodden and rode the headlong rush of waves out of the night on their frail, unstable vessel. Without speaking again, without even being able to see more than each other's vague shapes in the darkness, they quickly learned to balance the raft between them with coordinated subtle movements of their bodies. The wind increased in viciousness, but although the sea rose with it, they managed to keep the higher side of the raft headed into it, and only an occasional burst of spray splattered over them. After a while, Santan lapsed into an exhausted sleep, so deep that it was almost comatose. She awoke in daylight, a muted grey and dreary light in a world of wild grey waters and low, sagging grey clouds. Her companion on the raft was squatting on the canted, insecure deck beside her, and he was watching her steadfastly.
"Miss Sunshine," he said, as soon as she stirred and opened her eyes. "Never guessed it was you when you came aboard last night."
She sat up quickly, and the tiny raft dipped and rocked dangerously under them.
"Steady on, love. That's the ticket."
He put out a gnarled hand to restrain her. There was a tattoo of a mermaid on his forearm.
"My name's Ernie, miss. Leading seaman Ernie Simpson, of course. I knew you right away. Everybody on board knows Miss Sunshine."
He was skinny and old, thin grey hair plastered with salt to his forehead, and his face wrinkled as a prune. But though his teeth were yellow and crooked, his smile was kindly.
"What has happened to the others, Ernie?"
Frantically, Santan looked around her, the true horror of their situation coming over her again.
"Gone to Davy Jones, most of them."
"Davy Jones? Who is he?"
"Drowned, I mean. Rot the bloody Hun who did it."
The night had hidden the true extremity of their situation from Santan. The reality that was revealed now was infinitely more frightening than her imaginings. As they dropped into the swells, they were dwarfed by the cold, opaque canyons of the sea, and as they rode up and over the crests, the vista of loneliness was such as to force Santan to cringe down on the tiny deck. There was nothing but the water and the sky, no lifeboat nor swimmer, not even a seabird.
"We're all alone," she whispered. "Tussle.
Cheer up, love. We're all still kicking. That's what counts."
Ernie had been busy while she still slept. She saw that he had managed to glean a few fragments of debris and floating wreckage from the sea around them. There was a sheet of heavy gauge canvas dragging behind the raft. Around its edge, short lengths of hemp rope had been spliced into eye holes. It floated like some monstrous octopus with limp tentacles.
"Lifeboat cover."
Ernie saw her interest. "And those are ship's spars and some other odds and ends. Begging your pardon, miss. Never know what will come in useful." He had lashed this collection of wreckage together with the lengths of rope from the lifeboat cover, and even while he explained to Santan, he was working with scarred but nimble fingers splicing short pieces of rope into a single length.
"I'm thirsty,"
Santan whispered. The salt had scalded her mouth and her lips felt hot and bloated. "Think about something else," Ernie advised. "Here, give us a hand with this. Can you splice?" Santan shook her head. Ernie dropped all his H's, and as a Frenchwoman she sympathised with him and found it easy to like him. "It's easy. Come on, love. I'll learn you how. Watch." Ernie had a clasp knife attached by a lanyard to his belt, and he used the spike on the back of it to open the weave of the hemp. "One over one, like a snake into its hole. See?" Quickly, Santan got the hang of it. The work helped to take her mind off their awful predicament. "Do you know where we are, Ernie?" "I'm no navigator, Miss Sunshine, but we are west of the coast of Africa. How far off, I haven't a clue. But somewhere out there is Africa. Yesterday, at noonset, we were 110 miles offshore." "I'm sure you're right," Ernie nodded. "All I know is we've got the current helping us, and the wind also." He turned his face up to the sky. "If only we can use the wind."
"Have you got a plan, Ernie?"
"Always got a plan, miss. Not always a good one, I admit." He grinned at her. "Just get this rope finished first." As soon as they had a single length of rope, 20 feet long, Ernie handed her the clasp knife. "Tie it around your middle, love. That's the ticket. We don't want to drop it, do we?" He slid over the side of the raft and paddled like a dog to the dragging wreckage. With Santan heaving and shoving under his direction, they worked two of the salvaged spars into position and lashed them securely with the hemp rope.
"Outriggers," Ernie spluttered with seawater. "A trick I learned from the darkies in Hawaii."
The raft was dramatically stabilised, and Ernie crawled back on board.
"Now we can think about putting up some kind of a sail."
It took 4 abortive attempts before the two of them were able to rig a jury mast and hoist a sail hacked from the canvas of the boat cover.
"We aren't going to win the America's Cup, love, but we are moving. Look at the wake, Miss Sunshine."
They were spreading a sluggish, oily wake behind their cumbersome craft, and Ernie trimmed their tiny sail carefully.
2 knots at least, he estimated. "Well done, Miss Sunshine. You're a game one and no mistake. Couldn't have done that all alone."
He was perched on the stern of the raft, steering with a salvaged length of timber as a tiller.
"Now you settle down and take a rest, love. You and I will have to stand watches back to back."
All the rest of that day the wind came at them in gusts and squalls, and twice their clumsy mast was thrown overboard. Each time Ernie had to go into the water to retrieve it, and the effort required to lift the heavy spar and the wet canvas, then to re-step and lash it back in place, left Santan trembling and exhausted. At nightfall the wind moderated and held steady and gentle out of the southwest. The clouds broke up so they had glimpses of the stars.
"I'm tuckered out. You'll have to take a turn at the tiller, Miss Sunshine."
Ernie showed her how to steer, and the raft responded sullenly to the push of the tiller.
"That red star there, that's Antares, with a small white star on each side of him. Just like a sailor on shore leave with a girlfriend on each arm, begging your pardon, Miss Sunshine. But you just keep heading towards Antares, and we'll be all right."
The old seaman curled up at her feet like a friendly dog, and Santan crouched on the stern of the raft and held the crude tiller under one arm. The swells dropped with the wind, and it seemed to her that their passage through the water was faster. Looking back, she could see the green phosphorescence of their wake spreading out behind them. She watched the red giant Antares with his 2 consorts climb up the black velvet curtain of the sky. Because she was lonely and still afraid, she thought of Anna.
"My darling Anna, where are you? Are you still alive? Did you reach one of the lifeboats, or are you too clinging to some scrap of wreckage, waiting on the judgment of the sea?"
Her longing for the solid, bulky assurance of her old nurse was so intense that it threatened to turn her into a child once more, and she felt the childlike tears scalding her eyelids, and Antares' glaring red light blurred and multiplied before her. She wanted to crawl into Anna's lap and bury her face in the warm, soapy smell of her vast bosom, and she felt all the resolve and purpose of the day's struggle melt in her, and she thought how easy it would be to lie down beside Ernie and not have to try any more. She sobbed aloud. The sound of her own sob startled her, and suddenly she was angry with herself and her own weakness. She wiped the tears away with her thumbs and felt the gritty crunch of dried salt crystals on her eyelashes. Her anger grew stronger, and deliberately she turned it away from herself to the fates which so afflicted her. "Why?" she demanded of the great red star. "What have I ever done that you single me out? Are you punishing me? Michel and my father, Noir and Anna, everything I have ever loved, why do you do this to me?" She broke off the thought, appalled at how close she had come to blasphemy. She hunched over, placed her free hand on her own belly, and shivered with the cold. She tried to feel some sign of the life in her body, some swelling, some lump, some movement, but she was disappointed, and her anger returned full strength, and with it a kind of wild defiance. "I make a vow. As mercilessly as I have been afflicted, so hard will I fight to survive. You, whether you are god or devil, have thrust this upon me. So I give my oath. I will endure, and my son will endure through me." She was raving. She realized it, but did not care. She had risen to her knees and was shaking her fist at the red star in defiance and anger. "Come," she challenged, "do your worst, and let's have done." If she had expected a blast of thunder and a lightning bolt, there was none. Only the sound of the wind in the rude mast, and the scrap of sail, and the bubble of the wake under the stern of the raft. Saint-Ann sagged back onto her haunches, and grabbed the tiller, and grimly pointed the raft up into the east. In the first light of the day, a bird came and hovered above Santan's head. It was a small seabird, the dark blue-grey of a rifle barrel, with soft white chalky marks over its beady black eyes, and its wings were beautifully shaped and delicate, and its cry was lonely and soft. "Wake up, Ernie," Santan cried, and her swollen lips split at the effort, and a bubble of blood ran down her chin. The inside of her mouth was furry and dry as an old rabbit skin, and her thirst was a bright, burning thing. Ernie struggled up and looked about him dazedly. He seemed to have shrunk and withered during the night, and his lips were flaky and white and encrusted with salt crystals. "Look, Ernie, a bird," Santan mumbled through her bleeding lips. "A bird," Ernie echoed, staring up at it. "Land close." The bird turned and darted away low over the water and was lost to sight, steel-grey, against the dark grey sea. In the middle of the morning, Santan pointed ahead, her mouth and her lips so desiccated that she could not speak. There was a dark, tangled object floating on the surface just ahead of the raft. It wallowed and waved its tentacles like a monster from the depths. "Seek help," Ernie whispered. And when they were close enough, he gaffed it with a tiller arm and drew the heavy mat of vegetation alongside the raft. The stalk of the kelp was as thick as a man's arm and 5 meters long, with a bushy head of leaves at its end. It had obviously been torn from the rocks by the storm. Moaning softly with thirst, Ernie cut a length of the thick stalk. Under the rubbery skin, there was a pulpy section of stem and a hollow air chamber within. Ernie shaved the pulp with a clasp knife and thrust a handful of the shavings into Santan's mouth. It was running with sap. The taste was strong and unpleasant, iodine and peppery, but Santan let the liquid trickle down her throat and whispered with delight. They gorged themselves on the juice of the kelp and spat out the pith. Then they rested a while, and felt the strength flowing back into their bodies. Ernie took the tiller again and headed the raft down the path of the wind. The storm clouds had blown away, and the sun warmed them and dried their clothing. At first they held their faces up to its caress, but soon it became oppressive, and they tried to huddle away from it in the tiny patch of the shade from the sail. When the sun reached its zenith, they were exposed to the scourge of its full strength, and it sucked the moisture from their bodies. They squeezed a little more of the kelp juice, but now the unpleasant chemical taste nauseated Santaine, and she realized that if she vomited, she would lose so much of her precious fluids. They could drink the kelp juice only sparingly. With her back against the jury mast, Santaine stared out at the horizon. The great ring of threatening water that surrounded them, unbroken except in the east, where a line of sombre cloud lay low on the sea. It took her almost an hour to realize that despite the wind, the cloud had not changed shape. If anything, it had firmed and grown a hairline taller along the horizon. She could make out tiny irregularities, low peaks and valleys that did not alter shape as ordinary clouds would.
"Ernie," she whispered. "Ernie, look at those clouds."
The old man blinked his eyes and then rose slowly into a crouch. He started to make a soft moaning sound in his throat, and Santaine realized it was a sound of joy. She rose beside him and for the first time looked upon the continent of Africa.